years, and the factory proper lasted over 12 years. It ended with the complete ruin of the 300 cottage factories. Footnote. See Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1865. End of footnote. Wherever the nature of the process did not involve production on a large scale, the new industries that have sprung up in the last few decades, such as envelope making, steel pen making, etc., have, as a general rule, first passed through the handicraft stage and then the manufacturing stage, as short phases of transition to the factory stage. Transition is very difficult in those cases where the production of the article by manufacture consists not of a series of graduated processes, but of a great number of disconnected ones. This circumstance formed a great hindrance to the establishment of steel pen factories. Nevertheless, about 15 years ago, a machine was invented that automatically performed 6 separate operations at once. The first steel pens were supplied by the handicraft system in the year 1820 at £7.4 the gross. In 1830 they were supplied by manufacture at 8 shillings. And today the factory system supplies them to the trade at from 2 to 6 pence the gross. Footnote. Mr. Gillett erected in Birmingham the first steel pen factory on a large scale. It produced, so early as 1851, over 180 million of pens yearly, and consumed 120 tons of steel. Birmingham has the monopoly of this industry in the United Kingdom, and at present produces thousands of millions of steel pens. According to the census of 1861, the number of persons employed was 1,428, of whom 1,268 females from 5 years of age upwards. End of footnote. B. Reaction of the factory system on manufacture and domestic industries. Along with the development of the factory system and of the revolution in agriculture that accompanies it, production in all the other branches of industry not only extends but alters its character. The principle, carried out in the factory system, of analysing the process of production into its constituent phases and of solving the problems thus proposed by the application of mechanics, of chemistry, and of the whole range of the natural sciences, becomes the determining principle everywhere. Hence, machinery squeezes itself into the manufacturing industries first for one detail process, then for another. Thus, the solid crystal of their organization, based on the old division of labor, becomes dissolved and makes way for constant changes. Independently of this, a radical change takes place in the composition of the collective laborer, a change of the persons working in combination. In contrast with the manufacturing period, the division of labor is thenceforth based, wherever possible, on the employment of women, of children of all ages, and of unskilled laborers. In one word, on cheap labor, as it is characteristically called in England. This is the case not only with all production on a large scale, whether employing machinery or not, but also with the so-called domestic industry, whether carried on in the houses of the workpeople or in small workshops. This modern so-called domestic industry has nothing, except the name, in common with the old-fashioned domestic industry, the existence of which presupposes independent urban handicrafts, independent peasant farming, and above all, a dwelling house for the labourer and his family. That old-fashioned industry has now been converted into an outside department of the factory, the manufactory, or the warehouse. Besides the factory operatives, the manufacturing workmen and the handicraftsmen whom it concentrates in large masses at one spot and directly commands, capital also sets in motion, by means of invisible threads, another army, that of the workers in the domestic industries, who dwell in the large towns and are also scattered over the face of the country. An example, the shirt factory of Messrs. Tilly at Londonderry, which employs 1,000 operatives in the factory itself and 9,000 people spread up and down the country and working in their own houses. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1864. End of footnote. The exploitation of cheap and immature labour power is carried out in a more shameless manner in modern manufacture than in the factory proper. This is because the technical foundation of the factory system, namely the substitution of machines for muscular power and the light character of the labour, is almost entirely absent in manufacture, and at the same time women and over-young children are subjected in a most unconscionable way to the influence of poisonous or injurious substances. This exploitation is more shameless in the so-called domestic industry than in manufactures, and that because the power of resistance in the labourers decreases with their dissemination, because a whole series of plundering parasites insinuate themselves between the employer and the workman, because a domestic industry has always to compete either with the factory system or with manufacturing in the same branch of production, because poverty robs the workman of the conditions most essential to his labour, of space, light and ventilation, because employment becomes more and more irregular, and finally, because in these the last resorts of the masses made redundant by modern industry and agriculture, competition for work attains its maximum. Economy in the means of production, first systematically carried out in the factory system, and there from the very beginning coincident with the most reckless squandering of labour power and robbery of the conditions normally requisite for labour, this economy now shows its antagonistic and murderous side more and more in a given branch of industry, the less the social productive power of labour and the technical basis for a combination of processes are developed in that branch. C. Modern Manufacture. I now proceed, by a few examples, to illustrate the principles I have laid down. As a matter of fact, the reader is already familiar with numerous instances given in the chapter on the working day. In the hardware manufactures of Birmingham and the neighbourhood, there are employed, mostly in very heavy work, 30,000 children and young persons, besides 10,000 women. There they are to be seen in the unwholesome brass foundries, button factories, enamelling, galvanizing, and lacquering works. Footnote. And now, forsooth, children are employed at file-cutting in Sheffield. End of footnote. Owing to the excessive labour of their workpeople, both adult and non-adult, certain London houses where newspapers and books are printed have got the ill-omened name of slaughterhouses. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1866. End of footnote. Similar excesses are practised in bookbinding, where the victims are chiefly women, girls and children. Young persons have to do heavy work in rope walks and night work in salt mines, candle manufactories and chemical works. Young people are worked to death at turning the looms in silk weaving, when it is not carried on by machinery. Footnote. The Commissioner justly remarks that though as a rule machines take the place of men, here, literally, young persons replace machines. End of footnote. One of the most shameful, the most dirty, and the worst paid kinds of labour, and one on which women and young girls are by preference employed, is the sorting of rags. It is well known that Great Britain, apart from its own immense store of rags, is the emporium for the rag trade of the whole world. They flow in from Japan, from the most remote states of South America, and from the Canary Islands. But the chief source of their supply are Germany, France, Russia, Italy, Egypt, Turkey, Belgium, and Holland. They are used for manure, for making bed flocks, for shoddy, and they serve as the raw material of paper. The rag sorters are the medium for the spread of smallpox and other infectious diseases, and they themselves are the first victims. Footnote. See the report on the rag trade and numerous details in Public Health, 1866. End of footnote. A classical example of overwork, of hard and inappropriate labour, and of its brutalising effects on the workman from his childhood upwards, is afforded not only by coal mining and miners generally, but also by tile and brick-making, in which industry the recently invented machinery is, in England, used only here and there. Between May and September, the work lasts from 5 in the morning till 8 in the evening, and where the drying is done in the open air, it often lasts from 4 in the morning till 9 in the evening. Work from 5 in the morning till 7 in the evening is considered reduced and moderate. Both boys and girls of 6 and even of 4 years of age are employed. They work for the same number of hours, often longer, than the adults. The work is hard, and the summer heat increases the exhaustion. In a certain tile field at Moseley, for example, a young woman, 24 years of age, was in the habit of making 2,000 tiles a day with the assistance of 2 little girls, who carried the clay for her and stacked the tiles. These girls carried daily 10 tons up the slippery sides of the clay pits from a depth of 30 feet, and then for a distance of 210 feet. It is impossible for a child to pass through the purgatory of a tile field without great moral degradation. The low language which they are accustomed to hear from their tenderest years, the filthy, indecent, and shameless habits amidst which, unknowing and half-wild, they grow up, make them in afterlife lawless, abandoned, dissolute. A frightful source of demoralization is the mode of living. Each moulder, who is always a skilled labourer and the chief of a group, supplies his 7 subordinates with board and lodging in his cottage. Whether members of his family or not, the men, boys and girls all sleep in the cottage, which contains generally 2, exceptionally 3, rooms, all on the ground floor, and badly ventilated. These people are so exhausted after the day's hard work that neither the rules of health, of cleanliness, nor of decency are in the least observed. Many of these cottages are models of untidiness, dirt, and dust. The greatest evil of the system that employs young girls on this sort of work consists in this, that as a rule it chains them fast from childhood for the whole of their afterlife to the most abandoned rabble. They become rough, foul-mouthed boys, before nature has taught them that they are women. Clothed in a few dirty rags, the legs naked, far above the knees, hair and face besmeared with dirt, they learn to treat all feelings of decency and of shame with contempt. During mealtimes they lie at full length in the fields or watch the boys bathing in a neighbouring canal. Their heavy day's work at length completed, they put on better clothes and accompany the men to the public houses. That excessive insobriety is prevalent from childhood upwards among the whole of this class is only natural. The worst is that the brickmakers despair of themselves. "You might as well," said one of the better kind to a chaplain of Southallfield, "try to raise and improve the devil as a bricky, sir." Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1866. End of footnote. As to the manner in which capital affects an economy in the requisites of labour, in modern manufacture, in which I include all workshops of larger size except factories proper, official and most ample material bearing on it is to be found in the Public Health Reports 4, 1863, and 6, 1864. The description of the workshops, more especially those of the London printers and tailors, surpasses the most loathsome fantasies of our romance writers. The effect on the health of the workpeople is self-evident. Dr. Simon, the chief medical officer of the Privy Council and the official editor of the Public Health Reports, says, "In my fourth report, 1863, I showed how it is practically impossible for the workpeople to insist upon that which is their first sanitary right, viz., the right that, no matter what the work for which their employer brings them together, the labour, so far as it depends upon him, should be freed from all avoidably unwholesome conditions. I pointed out that while the workpeople are practically incapable of doing themselves this sanitary justice, they are unable to obtain any effective support from the paid administrations of the sanitary police. The life of myriads of workmen and workwomen is now uselessly tortured and shortened by the never-ending physical suffering that their mere occupation begets." Footnote. Public Health, 1864. End of footnote. D. Modern Domestic Industry. I now come to the so-called domestic industry. In order to get an idea of the horrors of this sphere, in which capital conducts its exploitation in the background of modern mechanical industry, one must go to the apparently quite idyllic trade of nail-making, carried on in a few remote villages of England. Footnote. I allude here to hammered nails, as distinguished from nails cut out and made by machinery. See Children's Employment Commission. End of footnote. In this place, however, it will be enough to give a few examples from those branches of the lace-making and straw-plaiting industries that are not yet carried on by the aid of machinery, and that as yet do not compete with branches carried on in factories or in manufactories. Of the 150,000 persons employed in England in the production of lace, about 10,000 fall under the authority of the Factory Act 1861. Almost the whole of the remaining 140,000 are women, young persons, and children of both sexes, the male sex, however, being weakly represented. The state of health of this cheap material for exploitation will be seen from the following table, computed by Dr. Truman, physician to the Nottingham General Dispensary. Out of 686 female patients who were lace-makers, most of them between the ages of 17 and 24, the number of consumptive ones were 1852, 1 in 45, 1857, 1 in 13, 1853, 1 in 28, 1858, 1 in 15, 1854, 1 in 17, 1859, 1 in 9, 1856, 1 in 15, 1861, 1 in 8. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission. End of footnote. This progress in the rate of consumption ought to suffice for the most optimist of progressists, and for the biggest hawker of lies among the free trade bagmen of Germany. The Factory Act of 1861 regulates the actual making of the lace, so far as it is done by machinery, and this is the rule in England. The branches that we are now about to examine, solely with regard to those of the workpeople who work at home, and not those who work in manufactories or warehouses, fall into two divisions, viz., 1. Finishing, 2. Mending. The former gives the finishing touches to the machine-made lace and includes numerous subdivisions. The lace finishing is done either in what are called mistresses' houses or by women in their own houses, with or without the help of their children. The women who keep the mistresses' houses are themselves poor. The workroom is in a private house. The mistresses take orders from manufacturers or from warehousemen, and employ as many women, girls, and young children as the size of their rooms and the fluctuating demand of the business will allow. The number of the workwomen employed in these workrooms varies from 20 to 40 in some, and from 10 to 20 in others. The average age at which the children commence work is 6 years, but in many cases it is below 5. The usual working hours are from 8 in the morning till 8 in the evening, with 1.5 hours for meals, which are taken at irregular intervals, and often in the foul workrooms. When business is brisk, the labour frequently lasts from 8 or even 6 o'clock in the morning till 10, 11, or 12 o'clock at night. In English barracks, the regulation space allotted to each soldier is 500 to 600 cubic feet, and in the military hospitals, 1,200 cubic feet. But in those finishing styes, there are but 67 to 100 cubic feet to each person. At the same time, the oxygen of the air is consumed by gas lights. In order to keep the lathe clean, and although the floor is tiled or gagged, the children are often compelled, even in winter, to pull off their shoes. It is not at all uncommon in Nottingham to find 14 to 20 children huddled together in a small room of, perhaps, not more than 12 feet square, and employed for 15 hours out of the 24 at work that of itself is exhausting from its weariness and monotony, and is besides carried on under every possible unwholesome condition. Even the very youngest children work with a strained attention and a rapidity that is astonishing, hardly ever giving their fingers rest or glowering their motion. If a question be asked them, they never raise their eyes from their work for fear of losing a single moment. The long stick is used by the mistresses as a stimulant more and more, as the working hours are prolonged. The children gradually tire and become as restless as birds towards the end of their long detention at an occupation that is monotonous, eye-straining, and exhausting from the uniformity in the posture of the body. Their work is like slavery. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1864. End of footnote. When women and their children work at home, which nowadays means in a hired room, often in a garret, the state of things is, if possible, still worse. This sort of work is given out within a circle of 80 miles radius from Nottingham. On leaving the warehouses at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, the children are often given a bundle of lace to take home with them and finish. The Pharisee of a capitalist, represented by one of his servants, accompanies this action, of course, with the unctuous phrase, "That's for mother," yet he knows well enough that the poor children must sit up and help. Pillow lace-making is chiefly carried on in England in two agricultural districts, one the Honiton Lace District, extending from 20 to 30 miles along the south coast of Devonshire, and including a few places in North Devon, the other comprising a great part of the counties of Buckingham, Bedford, and Northampton, and also the adjoining portions of Oxfordshire and Huntingdonshire. The cottages of the agricultural labourers are the places where the work is usually carried on. Many manufacturers employ upwards of 3,000 of these lace makers, who are chiefly children and young persons of the female sex exclusively. The state of things described as incidental to lace finishing is here repeated, save that instead of the mistresses' houses, we find what are called lace schools, kept by poor women in their cottages. From their 5th year, and often earlier, until their 12th or 15th year, the children work in these schools. During the 1st year, the very young ones work from 4 to 8 hours, and later on from 6 in the morning till 8 and 10 o'clock at night. The rooms are generally the ordinary living rooms of small cottages, the chimney stopped up to keep out draughts, the inmates kept warm by their own animal heat alone, and this frequently in winter. In other cases, these so-called schoolrooms are like small storerooms without fireplaces. The overcrowding in these dens and the consequent vitiation of the air are often extreme. Added to this is the injurious effect of drains, privies, decomposing substances, and other filth, usual in the purlieus of the smaller cottages. With regard to space, in one lace school, 18 girls and a mistress, 35 cubic feet to each person. In another, where the smell was unbearable, 18 persons and 24.5 cubic feet per head. In this industry are to be found employed children of 2 and 2.5 years. Where lace-making ends in the counties of Buckingham and Bedford, straw-plaiting begins, and extends over a large part of Hertfordshire and the westerly and northerly parts of Essex. In 1861, there were 40,043 persons employed in straw-plaiting and straw-hat-making. Of these, 3,815 were males of all ages, the rest females, of whom 14,913, including about 7,000 children, were under 20 years of age. In the place of the lace schools, we find here the straw-plait schools. The children commence their instruction in straw-plaiting, generally in their fourth, often between their third and fourth year. Education, of course, they get none. The children themselves call the elementary schools natural schools to distinguish them from these blood-sucking institutions in which they are kept at work simply to get through the task, generally 30 yards daily, prescribed by their half-starved mothers. These same mothers often make them work at home after school is over, until 10, 11, and 12 o'clock at night. The straw cuts their mouths, with which they constantly moisten it, and their fingers. Dr. Ballard gives it as the general opinion of the whole body of medical officers in London that 300 cubic feet is the minimum space proper for each person in a bedroom or workroom. But in the straw-plait schools, space is more sparingly allotted than in the lace schools. 12 2/3, 17, 18.5, and below 22 cubic feet for each person. The smaller of these numbers, says one of the commissioners, Mr. White, represents less space than the half of what a child would occupy if packed in a box measuring 3 feet in each direction. Thus do the children enjoy life till the age of 12 or 14. The wretched half-starved parents think of nothing but getting as much as possible out of their children. The latter, as soon as they are grown up, do not care a farthing, and naturally so, for their parents, and leave them. It is no wonder that ignorance and vice abound in a population so brought up. Their morality is at the lowest ebb. A great number of the women have illegitimate children, and that at such an immature age that even those most conversant with criminal statistics are astounded. And the native land of these model families is the pattern Christian country for Europe. So says at least Count Montalembert, certainly a competent authority on Christianity. Wages in the above industries, miserable as they are, the maximum wages of a child in the straw-plait schools rising in rare cases to 3 shillings, are reduced far below their nominal amount by the prevalence of the truck system everywhere, but especially in the lace districts. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission. End of footnote. E. Passage of modern manufacture and domestic industry into modern mechanical industry. The hastening of this revolution by the application of the Factory Acts to those industries. The cheapening of labour power by sheer abuse of the labour of women and children, by sheer robbery of every normal condition requisite for working and living, and by the sheer brutality of overwork and night work, meets at last with natural obstacles that cannot be overstepped. So also, when based on these methods, do the cheapening of commodities and capitalist exploitation in general. So soon as this point is at last reached, and it takes many years, the hour has struck for the introduction of machinery, and for the thenceforth rapid conversion of the scattered domestic industries, and also of manufactures, into factory industries. An example, on the most colossal scale of this movement, is afforded by the production of wearing apparel. This industry, according to the classification of the Children's Employment Commission, comprises straw hat makers, ladies' hat makers, cap makers, tailors, milliners and dressmakers, shirt-makers, corset-makers, glove-makers, shoemakers, besides many minor branches, such as the making of neckties, collars, etc. In 1861, the number of females employed in these industries in England and Wales amounted to 586,299. Of these, 115,242, at the least, were under 20, and 16,650 under 15 years of age. The number of these workwomen in the United Kingdom in 1861 was 750,334. The number of males employed in England and Wales in hat-making, shoemaking, glove-making and tailoring was 437,969. Of these, 14,964 under 15 years, 89,285 between 15 and 20, and 333,117 over 20 years. Many of the smaller branches are not included in these figures. But take the figures as they stand. We then have for England and Wales alone, according to the census of 1861, a total of 1,024,277 persons, about as many as are absorbed by agriculture and cattle breeding. We begin to understand what becomes of the immense quantities of goods conjured up by the magic of machinery and of the enormous masses of workpeople which that machinery sets free. The production of wearing apparel is carried on partly in manufactories in whose workrooms there is but a reproduction of that division of labour, the membra disjecta of which were found ready to hand, partly by small master-handy craftsmen. These, however, do not, as formerly, work for individual consumers, but for manufactories and warehouses, and to such an extent that often whole towns and stretches of country carry on certain branches, such as shoemaking, as a speciality. Finally, on a very great scale, by the so-called domestic workers, who form an external department of the manufactories, warehouses, and even of the workshops of the smaller masters. Footnote. In England, millinery and dressmaking are for the most part carried on the premises of the employer, partly by workwomen who live there, partly by women who live off the premises. End of footnote. The raw material, etc., is supplied by mechanical industry. The mass of cheap human material, taillable la merci et miséricorde, is composed of the individuals liberated by mechanical industry and improved agriculture. The manufactures of this class owed their origin chiefly to the capitalist need of having at hand an army ready equipped to meet any increase of demand. Footnote. Mr. White, a commissioner, visited a military clothing manufactory that employed 1,000 to 1,200 persons, almost all females, and a shoe manufactory with 1,300 persons. Of these, nearly one-half were children and young persons. End of footnote. These manufactures, nevertheless, allowed the scattered handicrafts and domestic industries to continue to exist as a broad foundation. The great production of surplus value in these branches of labour and the progressive cheapening of their articles were and are chiefly due to the minimum wages paid, no more than requisite for a miserable vegetation, and to the extension of working time up to the maximum endurable by the human organism. It was, in fact, by the cheapness of the human sweat and the human blood, which were converted into commodities, that the markets were constantly being extended, and continue daily to be extended. More especially was this the case with England's colonial markets, where, besides, English tastes and habits prevail. At last the critical point was reached. The basis of the old method, sheer brutality in the exploitation of the workpeople, accompanied more or less by a systematic division of labour, no longer sufficed for the extending markets and for the still more rapidly extending competition of the capitalists. the hour struck for the advent of machinery. The decisively revolutionary machine, the machine which attacks in an equal degree the whole of the numberless branches of this sphere of production, dressmaking, tailoring, shoemaking, sewing, hat-making, and many others, is the sewing machine. Its immediate effect on the workpeople is like that of all machinery, which, since the rise of modern industry, has seized upon new branches of trade. Children of too tender an age are sent adrift. The wage of the machine hands rises compared with that of the house workers, many of whom belong to the poorest of the poor. That of the better situated handicraftsmen, with whom the machine competes, sinks. The new machine hands are exclusively girls and young women. With the help of mechanical force, they destroy the monopoly that male labour had of the heavier work, and they drive off from the lighter work numbers of old women and very young children. The overpowering competition crushes the weakest of the manual labourers. The fearful increase in death from starvation during the last 10 years in London runs parallel with the extension of machine sewing. Footnote. An instance. The weekly report of deaths by the Registrar General, dated 26th of February 1864, contains 5 cases of death from starvation. On the same day, The Times reports another case. 6 victims of starvation in 1 week. End of footnote. The new workwomen turn the machines by hand and foot, or by hand alone, sometimes sitting, sometimes standing, according to the weight, size, and special make of the machine, and expend a great deal of labour power. Their occupation is unwholesome, owing to the long hours, although in most cases they are not so long as under the old system. Wherever the sewing machine locates itself in narrow and already overcrowded workrooms, it adds to the unwholesome influences. The effect, says Mr. Lord, on entering low-ceiled workrooms in which 30 to 40 machine hands are working, is unbearable. The heat, partly due to the gas stoves used for warming the irons, is horrible. Even when moderate hours of work, that is, from 8 in the morning till 6 in the evening, prevail in such places, yet 3 or 4 persons fall into a swoon regularly every day. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1864, end of footnote. The revolution in the industrial methods, which is the necessary result of the revolution in the instruments of production, is effected by a medley of transition forms. These forms vary according to the extent to which the sewing machine has become prevalent in one branch of industry or the other, to the time during which it has been in operation, to the previous condition of the workpeople, to the preponderance of manufacture, of handicrafts, or of domestic industry, to the rent of the workrooms, etc. Footnote. The rental of premises required for workrooms seems the element which ultimately determines the point, and consequently it is in the metropolis that the old system of giving work out to small employers and families has been longest retained, and earliest returned to. The concluding statement in this quotation refers exclusively to shoemaking. End of footnote. In dressmaking, for instance, where the labour for the most part was already organised, chiefly by simple cooperation, the sewing machine at first formed merely a new factor in that manufacturing industry. In tailoring, shirt-making, shoemaking, etc., all the forms are intermingled. Here the factory system proper. There middlemen receive the raw material from the capitalist en chef and group around their sewing machines in chambers and garrets from 10 to 50 or more workwomen. Finally, as is always the case with machinery when not organized into a system and when it can also be used in dwarfish proportions, handicraftsmen and domestic workers, along with their families or with a little extra labour from without, make use of their own sewing machines. Footnote. In glove-making and other industries where the condition of the workpeople is hardly distinguishable from that of paupers, this does not occur. End of footnote. The system actually prevalent in England is that the capitalist concentrates a large number of machines on his premises and then distributes the produce of those machines for further manipulation amongst the domestic workers. The variety of the transition forms, however, does not conceal the tendency to conversion into the factory system proper. This tendency is nurtured by the very nature of the sewing machine, the manifold uses of which push on the concentration under one roof and one management of previously separated branches of a trade. It is also favoured by the circumstance that preparatory needlework and certain other operations are most conveniently done on the premises where the machine is at work, as well as by the inevitable expropriation of the hand sewers and of the domestic workers who work with their own machines. This fate has already in part overtaken them. The constantly increasing amount of capital invested in sewing machines gives the spur to the production of, and gluts the markets with, machine-made articles, thereby giving the signal to the domestic workers for the sale of their machines. Footnote. In the wholesale boot and shoe trade of Leicester alone, there were in 1864 800 sewing machines already in use. The overproduction of sewing machines themselves causes their producers, in bad want of a sale, to let them out for so much a week, thus crushing by their deadly competition the small owners of machines. Constant changes in the construction of the machines and their ever-increasing cheapness depreciate day by day the older makes, and allow of their being sold in great numbers at absurd prices to large capitalists, who alone can thus employ them at a profit. Finally, the substitution of the steam engine, for man gives in this, as in all similar revolutions, the finishing blow. At first, the use of steam power meets with mere technical difficulties, such as unsteadiness in the machines, difficulty in controlling their speed, rapid wear and tear of the lighter machines, etc., all of which are soon overcome by experience. Footnote. Instances. The Army Clothing Depot at Pimlico, London, the shirt factory of Tilly and Henderson at Londonderry, and the clothes factory of Messrs. Tate at Limerick, which employs about 1,200 hands. End of footnote. If, on the one hand, the concentration of many machines in large manufactories leads to the use of steam power, on the other hand, the competition of steam with human muscles hastens on the concentration of workpeople and machines in large factories. Thus, England is at present experiencing, not only in the colossal industry of making wearing apparel, but in most of the other trades mentioned before, the conversion of manufacture, of handicrafts, and of domestic work into the factory system. After each of those forms of production, totally changed and disorganized under the influence of modern industry, has long ago reproduced, and even overdone, all the horrors of the factory system without participating in any of the elements of social progress it contains. Footnote. Tendency to factory system. The whole employment is at this time in a state of transition, and is undergoing the same change as that effected in the lace trade, weaving, etc. A complete revolution. At the date of the Children's Employment Commission of 1840, stocking-making was still done by manual labour. Since 1846, various sorts of machines have been introduced, which are now driven by steam. The total number of persons of both sexes and of all ages from 3 years upwards employed in stocking-making in England was in 1862 about 129,000. Of these, only 4,063 were, according to the parliamentary return of the 11th of February 1862, working under the Factory Acts. End of footnote. This industrial revolution, which takes place spontaneously, is artificially helped on by the extension of the Factory Acts to all industries in which women, young persons, and children are employed. the compulsory regulation of the working day as regards its length, pauses, beginning and end, the system of relays of children, the exclusion of all children under a certain age, etc., necessitate, on the one hand, more machinery and the substitution of steam as a motive power in the place of muscles. Footnote. Thus, for example, in the earthenware trade, Messrs. Cochrane of the Britain Pottery, Glasgow, report, "To keep up our quantity, we have gone extensively into machines wrought by unskilled labour, and every day convinces us that we can produce a greater quantity than by the old method." Report of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1865. The effect of the Factory Acts is to force on the further introduction of machinery. Also, thus, after the extension of the Factory Act to the potteries, great increase of power jiggers in place of hand-moved jiggers. End of footnote. On the other hand, in order to make up for the loss of time, an expansion occurs of the means of production used in common of the furnaces, buildings, etc. In one word, greater concentration of the means of production and a correspondingly greater concourse of workpeople. The chief objection, repeatedly and passionately urged on behalf of each manufacturer threatened with the Factory Act, is in fact this, that in order to continue the business on the old scale, a greater outlay of capital will be necessary. But as regards labour in the so-called domestic industries and the intermediate forms between them and manufacture, so soon as limits are put to the working day and to the employment of children, those industries go to the wall. Unlimited exploitation of cheap labour power is the sole foundation of their power to compete. One of the essential conditions for the existence of the factory system, especially when the length of the working day is fixed, is certainty in the result, that is, the production in a given time of a given quantity of commodities, or of a given useful effect. The statutory pauses in the working day, moreover, imply the assumption that periodical and sudden cessation of the work does no harm to the article undergoing the process of production. This certainty in the result, and this possibility of interrupting the work, are, of course, easier to be attained in the purely mechanical industries than in those which chemical and physical processes play a part, as, for instance, in the earthenware trade, in bleaching, dyeing, baking, and in most of the metal industries. Wherever there is a working day without restriction as to length, wherever there is night work and unrestricted waste of human life, there the slightest obstacle presented by the nature of the work to a change for the better is soon looked upon as an everlasting barrier erected by nature. No poison kills vermin with more certainty than the Factory Act removes such everlasting barriers. No one made a greater outcry over impossibilities than our friends the earthenware manufacturers. In 1864, however, they were brought under the Act, and within 16 months every impossibility had vanished. The improved method, called forth by the Act, of making slip by pressure instead of by evaporation, the newly constructed stoves for drying the ware in its green state, etc., are each events of great importance in the pottery art, and mark an advance which the preceding century could not rival. It has even considerably reduced the temperature of the stoves themselves, with a considerable saving of fuel, and with a readier effect on the ware. Footnote. Report of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1865. End of footnote. In spite of every prophecy, the cost price of earthenware did not rise, but the quantity produced did, and to such an extent that the export for the 12 months ending December 1865 exceeded in value by £138,628 the average of the preceding 3 years. In the manufacture of matches, it was thought to be an indispensable requirement that boys, even while bolting their dinner, should go on dipping the matches in melted phosphorus the poisonous vapour from which rose into their faces. The Factory Act, 1864, made the saving of time a necessity, and so forced into existence a dipping machine, the vapour from which could not come into contact with the workers. Footnote. The introduction of this and other machinery into matchmaking caused in one department alone 230 young persons to be replaced by 32 boys and girls of 14 to 17 years of age. This saving in labour was carried still further in 1865 by the employment of steam power. End of footnote. So, at the present time, in those branches of the lace manufacture not yet subject to the Factory Act, it is maintained that the meal times cannot be regular, owing to the different periods required by the various kinds of lace for drying, which periods vary from 3 minutes up to an hour or more. To this the Children's Employment Commissioners answer, "The circumstances of this case are precisely analogous to that of the paper stainers, dealt with in our first report. Some of the principal manufacturers in the trade urge that in consequence of the nature of the materials used and their various processes, they would be unable, without serious loss, to stop for meal times at any given moment. But it was seen from the evidence that, by due care and previous arrangement, the apprehended difficulty would be got over, and, accordingly, by Clause 6 of Section 6 of the Factory Act's Extension Act, passed during this session of Parliament, an interval of 18 months is given to them from the passing of the Act before they are required to conform to the meal hours specified by the Factory Acts." Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1864, end of footnote. Hardly had the Act been passed when our friends the manufacturers found out the inconveniences we expected to arise from the introduction of the Factory Acts into our branch of manufacture, I am happy to say, have not arisen. We do not find the production at all interfered with. In short, we produce more in the same time. Footnote. Report of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1865. End of footnote. It is evident that the English legislature, which certainly no one will venture to reproach with being overdosed with genius, has been led by experience to the conclusion that a simple compulsory law is sufficient to enact away all the so-called impediments opposed by the nature of the process to the restriction and regulation of the working day. Hence, on the introduction of the Factory Act into a given industry, a period varying from 6 to 18 months is fixed within which it is incumbent on the manufacturers to remove all technical impediments to the working of the Act. Mirabeau's impossible ne me dites jamais ce bête de mot is particularly applicable to modern technology. But though the Factory Acts thus artificially ripen the material elements necessary for the conversion of the manufacturing system into the factory system, yet at the same time, owing to the necessity they impose for greater outlay of capital, they hasten on the decline of the small masters and the concentration of capital. Footnote. But it must be borne in mind that those improvements, though carried out fully in some establishments, are by no means general, and are not capable of being brought into use in many of the old manufactories without an expenditure of capital beyond the means of many of the present occupiers. "I cannot but rejoice," writes Sub-Inspector May, "that notwithstanding the temporary disorganization which inevitably follows the introduction of such a measure, as the Factory Act Extension Act, and is indeed directly indicative of the evils which it was intended to remedy, etc." Report of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1865. End of footnote. Besides the purely technical impediments that are removable by technical means, the irregular habits of the workpeople themselves obstruct the regulation of the hours of labour. This is especially the case where piece wage predominates, and where loss of time in one part of the day or week can be made good by subsequent overtime, or by night work, a process which brutalizes the adult workman and ruins his wife and children. Footnote. With blast furnaces, for instance, work towards the end of the week being generally much increased in duration in consequence of the habit of the men of idling on Monday, and occasionally during a part or the whole of Tuesday also. Children's Employment Commission. The little masters generally have very irregular hours. They lose 2 or 3 days and then work all night to make it up. They always employ their own children if they have any. The want of regularity in coming to work, encouraged by the possibility and practice of making up for this by working longer hours. In Birmingham, an enormous amount of time is lost, idling part of the time, slaving the rest. End of footnote. Although this absence of regularity in the expenditure of labour power is a natural and rude reaction against the tedium of monotonous drudgery, it originates also to a much greater degree from anarchy in production, anarchy that, in its turn, presupposes unbridled exploitation of labour power by the capitalist. Besides the general periodic changes of the industrial cycle and the special fluctuations in the markets to which each industry is subject, we may also reckon what is called the season, dependent either on the periodicity of favourable seasons of the year for navigation, or on fashion, and the sudden placing of large orders that have to be executed in the shortest possible time. The habit of giving such orders becomes more frequent with the extension of railways and telegraphs. The extension of the railway system throughout the country has tended very much to encourage giving short notice. Purchasers now come up from Glasgow, Manchester, and Edinburgh once every fortnight or so to the wholesale city warehouses which we supply, and give small orders requiring immediate execution, instead of buying from stock as they used to do. Years ago, we were always able to work in the slack times, so as to meet demand of the next season, but now no one can say beforehand what will be the demand then. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission. The extension of the railway system is said to have contributed greatly to this custom of giving sudden orders, and the consequent hurry, neglect of meal times, and late hours of the workpeople. End of footnote. In those factories and manufactories that are not yet subject to the Factory Acts, the most fearful overwork prevails periodically during what is called the season, in consequence of sudden orders. In the outside department of the factory, of the manufactory, and of the warehouse, the so-called domestic workers, whose employment is at best irregular, are entirely dependent for their raw material and their orders on the caprice of the capitalist, who, in this industry, is not hampered by any regard for depreciation of his buildings and machinery, and risks nothing by a stoppage of work but the skin of the worker himself. Here, then, he sets himself systematically to work to form an industrial reserve force that shall be ready at a moment's notice. During one part of the year, he decimates this force by the most inhuman toil. During the other part, he lets it starve for want of work. The employers avail themselves of the habitual irregularity in the homework, when any extra work is wanted at a push, so that the work goes on till 11 and 12 p.m. or 2 a.m., or, as the usual phrase is, all hours, and that in localities where the stench is enough to knock you down. You go to the door, perhaps, and open it, but shudder to go further. "They are curious men," said one of the witnesses, a shoemaker, speaking of the masters. "They think it does a boy no harm to work too hard for half a year, if he is nearly idle for the other half." In the same way as technical impediments, so too those usages which have grown with the growth of trade were and still are proclaimed by interested capitals as obstacles due to the nature of the work. This was the favourite cry of the cotton lords at the time they were first threatened with the Factory Acts. Although their industry more than any other depends on navigation, yet experience has given them the lie. Since then, every pretended obstruction to business has been treated by the factory inspectors as a mere sham. Footnote. With respect to the loss of trade by non-completion of shipping orders in time, I remember that this was the pet argument of the factory masters in 1832 and 1833. Nothing that can be advanced now on this subject could have the force that it had then, before steam had halved all distances and established new regulations for transit. It quite failed at that time of proof when put to the test, and again it will certainly fail should it have to be tried. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1862. End of footnote. The thoroughly conscientious investigations of the Children's Employment Commission prove that the effect of the regulation of the hours of work in some industries was to spread the mass of labour previously employed more evenly over the whole year, that this regulation was the first rational bridle on the murderous, meaningless caprices of fashion, caprices that consort so badly with the system of modern industry. Footnote. John Bellars remarked as far back as 1699, "The uncertainty of fashions does increase necessitous poor. It has two great mischiefs in it. First, the journeymen are miserable in winter for want of work, the mercers and master weavers not daring to lay out their stocks to keep the journeymen employed before the spring comes, and they know what the fashion will then be. Secondly, in the spring the journeymen are not sufficient, but the master weavers must draw in many prentices, that they may supply the trade of the kingdom in a quarter or half a year, which robs the plough of hands, drains the country of labourers, and in a great part stocks the city with beggars, and starves some in winter that are ashamed to beg. Essays about the poor, manufactures, etc. End of footnote. That the development of ocean navigation and of the means of communication generally has swept away the technical basis on which season work was really supported, and that all other so-called unconquerable difficulties vanish before larger buildings, additional machinery, increase in the number of workpeople employed, and the alterations caused by all these in the mode of conducting the wholesale trade. Footnote. The evidence of some Bradford export houses is as follows. Under these circumstances, it seemed clear that no boys need be worked longer than from 8 a.m. to 7 or 7:30 p.m. in making up. It is merely a question of extra hands and extra outlay. If some masters were not so greedy, the boys would not work late. An extra machine costs only £16 or £18. Much of such overtime as does occur is to be referred to an insufficiency of appliances and a want of space. End of footnote. Footnote. A London manufacturer, who in other respects looks upon the compulsory regulation of the hours of labour as a protection for the workpeople against the manufacturers, and for the manufacturers themselves against the wholesale trade, states, "The pressure in our business is caused by the shippers, who want, for example, to send the goods by sailing vessels so as to reach their destination at a given season, and at the same time want to pocket the difference in freight between a sailing vessel and a steamship, or who select the earlier of two steamships in order to be in the foreign market before their competitors." End of footnote. But for all that, capital never becomes reconciled to such changes, and this is admitted over and over again by its own representatives, except under the pressure of a general act of Parliament for the compulsory regulation of the hours of labour. Footnote. "This could be obviated," says a manufacturer, "at the expense of an enlargement of the works under the pressure of a general act of Parliament." End of footnote. Section 9. The Factory Acts. Sanitary and educational clauses of the same. Their general extension in England. Factory legislation, that first conscious and methodical reaction of society against the spontaneously developed form of the process of production, is, as we have seen, just as much the necessary product of modern industry as cotton yarn, self-actors, and the electric telegraph. Before passing to the consideration of the extension of that legislation in England, we shall shortly notice certain clauses contained in the Factory Acts, and not relating to the hours of work. Apart from their wording, which makes it easy for the capitalists to evade them, the sanitary clauses are extremely meagre, and in fact limited to provisions for whitewashing the walls, for ensuring cleanliness in some other matters, for ventilation, and for protection against dangerous machinery. In the third book, we shall return again to the fanatical opposition of the masters to those clauses which imposed upon them a slight expenditure on appliances for protecting the limbs of their workpeople, an opposition that throws a fresh and glaring light on the free trade dogma, according to which, in a society with conflicting interests, each individual necessarily furthers the common weal by seeking nothing but his own personal advantage. One example is enough. The reader knows that during the last 20 years the flax industry has very much extended, and that with that extension the number of scutching mills in Ireland has increased. In 1864 there were in that country 1,800 of these mills. Regularly in autumn and winter, women and young persons, the wives, sons, and daughters of the neighbouring small farmers, a class of people totally unaccustomed to machinery, are taken from field labour to feed the rollers of the scutching mills with flax. The accidents, both as regards number and kind, are wholly unexampled in the history of machinery. In one scutching mill at Kildinan, near Cork, there occurred between 1852 and 1856 6 fatal accidents and 60 mutilations, every one of which might have been prevented by the simplest appliances at the cost of a few shillings. Dr. W. White, the certifying surgeon for factories at Downpatrick, states in his official report, dated the 15th of December 1865, "The serious accidents at the scutching mills are of the most fearful nature. In many cases a quarter of the body is torn from the trunk, and either involves death or a future of wretched incapacity and suffering. The increase of mills in the country will, of course, extend these dreadful results, and it will be a great boon if they are brought under the legislature. I am convinced that by proper supervision of scutching mills, a vast sacrifice of life and limb would be averted." What could possibly show better the character of the capitalist mode of production than the necessity that exists for forcing upon it, by acts of Parliament, the simplest appliances for maintaining cleanliness and health? In the potteries, the Factory Act of 1864 has whitewashed and cleansed upwards of 200 workshops after a period of abstinence from any such cleaning, in many cases, of 20 years, and in some, entirely. This is the abstinence of the capitalist, in which were employed 27,800 artisans, hitherto breathing through protracted days and often nights of labour a mephitic atmosphere, and which rendered an otherwise comparatively innocuous occupation pregnant with disease and death. The Act has improved the ventilation very much. At the same time, this portion of the Act strikingly shows that the capitalist mode of production, owing to its very nature, excludes all rational improvement beyond a certain point. It has been stated over and over again that the English doctors are unanimous in declaring that where the work is continuous, 500 cubic feet is the very least space that should be allowed for each person. Now, if the Factory Acts, owing to their compulsory provisions, indirectly hasten on the conversion of small workshops into factories, thus indirectly attacking the proprietary rights of the smaller capitalists and assuring a monopoly to the great ones, so, if it were made obligatory to provide the proper space for each workman in every workshop, thousands of small employers would, at one full swoop, be expropriated directly. The very root of the capitalist mode of production, that is, the self-expansion of all capital, large or small, by means of the free purchase and consumption of labour power, would be attacked. Factory legislation is therefore brought to a deadlock before these 500 cubic feet of breathing space. The sanitary officers, the industrial inquiry commissioners, the factory inspectors, all harp over and over again upon the necessity for those 500 cubic feet, and upon the impossibility of wringing them out of capital. They thus, in fact, declare that consumption and other lung diseases among the workpeople are necessary conditions to the existence of capital. Footnote. It has been found out by experiment that with each respiration of average intensity made by a healthy average individual, about 25 cubic inches of air are consumed, and that about 20 respirations are made in each minute. Hence, the air inhaled in 24 hours by each individual is about 720,000 cubic inches, or 416 cubic feet. It is clear, however, that air which has been once breathed can no longer serve for the same process until it has been purified in the great workshop of nature. According to the experiments of Valentin and Brunner, it appears that a healthy man gives off about 1,300 cubic inches of carbonic acid per hour. This would give about 8 ounces of solid carbon thrown off from the lungs in 24 hours. Every man should have at least 800 cubic feet. Huxley. End of footnote. Paltry as the education clauses of the Act appear on the whole, yet they proclaim elementary education to be an indispensable condition to the employment of children. Footnote. According to the English Factory Act, parents cannot send their children under 14 years of age into factories under the control of the Act, unless at the same time they allow them to receive elementary education. The manufacturer is responsible for compliance with the Act. Factory education is compulsory, and it is a condition of labour. End of footnote. The success of those clauses proved for the first time the possibility of combining education and gymnastics with manual labour, and consequently of combining manual labour with education and gymnastics. Footnote. On the very advantageous results of combining gymnastics, and drilling in the case of boys, with compulsory education for factory children and pauper scholars, see the speech of N.W. Senior at the 7th Annual Congress of the National Association for the Promotion of Social Science, in Reports of Proceedings, etc., end of footnote. The factory inspectors soon found out by questioning the schoolmasters that the factory children, although receiving only one half the education of the regular day scholars, yet learnt quite as much and often more. This can be accounted for by the simple fact that, with only being at school for one half of the day, they are always fresh and nearly always ready and willing to receive instruction. The system on which they work, half manual labour and half school, renders each employment a rest and a relief to the other. Consequently, both are far more congenial to the child than would be the case were he kept constantly at one. It is quite clear that a boy who has been at school all morning cannot, in hot weather particularly, cope with one who comes fresh and bright from his work. Footnote. A silk manufacturer naively states to the Children's Employment Commissioners, "I am quite sure that the true secret of producing efficient workpeople is to be found in uniting education and labour from a period of childhood." Of course, the occupation must not be too severe, nor irksome or unhealthy. But of the advantage of the union, I have no doubt. I wish my own children could have some work, as well as play, to give variety to their schooling. End of footnote. Further information on this point will be found in Senior's speech at the Social Science Congress at Edinburgh in 1863. He there shows, amongst other things, how the monotonous and uselessly long school hours of the children of the upper and middle classes uselessly add to the labour of the teacher, while he not only fruitlessly but absolutely injuriously wastes the time, health, and energy of the children. Footnote. How modern industry, when it has attained to a certain pitch, is capable, by the revolution it effects in the mode of production and in the social conditions of production, of also revolutionizing people's minds, is strikingly shown by a comparison of Senior's speech in 1863 with his philippic against the Factory Act of 1833, or by a comparison of the views of the Congress referred to with the fact that in certain country districts of England, poor parents are forbidden, on pain of death by starvation, to educate their children. Thus, for example, Mr. Snell reports it to be a common occurrence in Somersetshire that when a poor person claims parish relief, he is compelled to take his children from school. Mr. Wallerton, the clergyman at Feltham, also tells of cases where all relief was denied to certain families because they were sending their children to school. End of footnote. From the factory system, as Robert Owen has shown us in detail, budded the germ of the education of the future, an education that will, in the case of every child over a given age, combine productive labour with instruction and gymnastics, not only as one of the methods of adding to the efficiency of production, but as the only method of producing fully developed human beings. Modern industry, as we have seen, sweeps away by technical means the manufacturing division of labour, under which each man is bound hand and foot for life to a single detail operation. At the same time, the capitalistic form of that industry reproduces this same division of labour in a still more monstrous shape. In the factory proper, by converting the workman into a living appendage of the machine, and everywhere outside the factory, partly by the sporadic use of machinery and machine workers, partly by re-establishing the division of labour on a fresh basis by the general introduction of the labour of women and children, and of cheap, unskilled labour. Footnote. Wherever handicraft machines driven by men compete directly or indirectly with more developed machines driven by mechanical power, a great change takes place with regard to the labourer who drives the machines. At first, the steam engine replaces this labourer. Afterwards, he must replace the steam engine. Consequently, the tension and the amount of tambour power expended become monstrous, and especially so in the case of the children who are condemned to this torture. Thus, Mr. Long, one of the commissioners, found in Coventry and the neighbourhood boys of from 10 to 15 years employed in driving the ribbon looms, not to mention younger children who had to drive smaller machines. It is extraordinarily fatiguing work. The boy is a mere substitute for steam power. Children's Employment Commission, 1866, end of footnote. The antagonism between the manufacturing division of labour and the methods of modern industry makes itself forcibly felt. It manifests itself, amongst other ways, in the frightful fact that a great part of the children employed in modern factories and manufactures are from their earliest years riveted to the most simple manipulations and exploited for years, without being taught a single sort of work that would afterwards make them of use, even in the same manufactory or factory. In the English letterpress printing trade, for example, there existed formerly a system corresponding to that in the old manufactures and handicrafts of advancing the apprentices from easy to more and more difficult work. They went through a course of teaching till they were finished printers. To be able to read and write was for every one of them a requirement of their trade. All this was changed by the printing machine. It employs two sorts of labourers, one grown-up, renters, the other, boys mostly from 11 to 17 years of age, whose sole business is either to spread the sheets of paper under the machine, or to take from it the printed sheets. They perform this weary task, in London especially, for 14, 15, and 16 hours at a stretch, during several days in the week, and frequently for 36 hours, with only 2 hours rest for meals and sleep. A great part of them cannot read, and they are, as a rule, utter savages, and very extraordinary creatures. To qualify them for the work which they have to do, they require no intellectual training. There is little room in it for skill, and less for judgment. Their wages, though rather high for boys, do not increase proportionately as they grow up, and the majority of them cannot look for advancement to the better paid and more responsible post of machine minder, because while each machine has but one minder, it has at least two, and often four, boys attached to it. As soon as they get too old for such child's work, that is about 17 at the latest, they are discharged from the printing establishments. They become recruits of crime. Several attempts to procure them employment elsewhere were rendered of no avail by their ignorance and brutality, and by their mental and bodily degradation. As with the division of labour in the interior of the manufacturing workshops, so it is with the division of labour in the interior of society. So long as handicraft and manufacture form the general groundwork of social production, the subjection of the producer to one branch exclusively, the breaking up of the multifariousness of his employment is a necessary step in the development. Footnote. In some parts of the Highlands of Scotland, not many years ago, every peasant, according to the statistical account, made his own shoes of leather tanned by himself. Many a shepherd and cottar too, with his wife and children, appeared at church in clothes which had been touched by no hands but their own, since they were shorn from the sheep and sown in the flax field. In the preparation of these, it is added, scarcely a single article had been purchased, except the awl, needle, thimble, and a very few parts of the ironwork employed in the weaving. The dyes were chiefly extracted by the women from trees, shrubs, and herbs. Dugald Stewart's Works, Hamilton's edition. End of footnote. On that groundwork, each separate branch of production acquires empirically the form that it is technically suited to it, slowly perfects it, and so soon as a given degree of maturity has been reached, rapidly crystallizes that form. The only thing that here and there causes a change, besides new raw materials supplied by commerce, is the gradual alteration of the instruments of labour. But their form, too, once definitely settled by experience, petrifies, as is proved by their being in many cases handed down in the same form by one generation to another during thousands of years. A characteristic feature is that, even down into the 18th century, the different trades were called mysteries. Into their secrets, none but those duly initiated could penetrate. Footnote. In the celebrated Livre des Métiers of Étienne Boileau, we find it prescribed that a journeyman, on being admitted among the masters, had to swear to love his brethren with brotherly love, to support them in their respective trades, not wilfully to betray the secrets of the trade, and besides, in the interests of all, not to recommend his own wares by calling the attention of the buyer to defects in the articles made by others. End of footnote. Modern industry rent the veil that concealed from men their own social process of production, and that turned the various, spontaneously divided branches of production into so many riddles not only to outsiders, but even to the initiated. The principle which it pursued of resolving each process into its constituent movements, without any regard to their possible execution by the hand of man, created the new modern science of technology. The varied, apparently unconnected and petrified forms of the industrial processes now resolve themselves into so many conscious and systematic applications of natural science to the attainment of given useful effects. Technology also discovered the few main fundamental forms of motion which, despite the diversity of the instruments used, are necessarily taken by every productive action of the human body, just as the science of mechanics sees in the most complicated machinery nothing but the continual repetition of the simple mechanical powers. Modern industry never looks upon and treats the existing form of a process as final. The technical basis of that industry is therefore revolutionary, while all earlier modes of production were essentially conservative. Footnote. The bourgeoisie cannot exist without continually revolutionizing the instruments of production, and thereby the relations of production and all the social relations. Conservation, in an unaltered form, of the old modes of production was on the contrary the first condition of existence for all earlier industrial classes. Constant revolution in production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguished the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast-frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new-formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned. And man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind. Friedrich Engels and Karl Marx, Manifest der Kommunistischen Partei, 1848, end of footnote. By means of machinery, chemical processes, and other methods, it is continually causing changes not only in the technical basis of production, but also in the functions of the labourer and in the social combinations of the labour process. At the same time, it thereby also revolutionizes the division of labor within the society and incessantly launches masses of capital and of workpeople from one branch of production to another. But if modern industry, by its very nature, therefore necessitates variation of labor, fluency of function, universal mobility of the laborer, on the other hand, in its capitalistic form, it reproduces the old division of labor with its ossified particularizations. We have seen how this absolute contradiction between the technical necessities of modern industry and the social character inherent in its capitalistic form dispels all fixity and security in the situation of the laborer, how it constantly threatens, by taking away the instruments of labor, to snatch from his hands his means of subsistence, and, by suppressing his detail function, to make him superfluous. Footnote. You take my life, when you do take the means whereby I live. Shakespeare. End of footnote. We have seen, too, how this antagonism vents its rage in the creation of that monstrosity, an industrial reserve army, kept in misery in order to be always at the disposal of capital. In the incessant human sacrifices from among the working class, in the most reckless squandering of labor power, and in the devastation caused by a social anarchy which turns every economic progress into a social calamity. This is the negative side. But if, on the one hand, variation of work at present imposes itself after the manner of an overpowering natural law and with the blindly destructive action of a natural law that meets with resistance at all points, modern industry, on the other hand, through its catastrophes, imposes the necessity of recognizing, as a fundamental law of production, variation of work, consequently fitness of the laborer for varied work, consequently the greatest possible development of his varied aptitudes. Footnote. A French workman, on his return from San Francisco, writes as follows. I never could have believed that I was capable of working at the various occupations I was employed on in California. I was firmly convinced that I was fit for nothing but letterpress printing. Once in the midst of this world of adventurers, who changed their occupation as often as they do their shirt, egad, I did as the others. As mining did not turn out remunerative enough, I left it for the town, where in succession I became typographer, slater, plumber, etc. In consequence of thus finding out that I am fit to any sort of work, I feel less of a mollusk and more of a man. A. Corbon, de l'enseignement professionnel. End of footnote. It becomes a question of life and death for society to adapt the mode of production to the normal functioning of this law. Modern industry, indeed, compels society under penalty of death to replace the detail worker of today, grappled by lifelong repetition of one and the same trivial operation, and thus reduced to the mere fragment of a man, by the fully developed individual, fit for a variety of labours, ready to face any change of production, and to whom the different social functions he performs are but so many modes of giving free scope to his own natural and acquired powers. One step already spontaneously taken towards effecting this revolution is the establishment of technical and agricultural schools and of écoles d'enseignement professionnel, in which the children of the working men receive some little instruction in technology and in the practical handling of the various implements of labour. Though the Factory Act, that first and meagre concession wrung from capital, is limited to combining elementary education with work in the factory, there can be no doubt that when the working class comes into power, as inevitably it must, technical instruction, both theoretical and practical, will take its proper place in the working class schools. There is also no doubt that such revolutionary ferments, the final result of which is the abolition of the old division of labour, are diametrically opposed to the capitalistic form of production and to the economic status of the labourer corresponding to that form. But the historical development of the antagonisms, immanent in a given form of production, is the only way in which that form of production can be dissolved and a new form established. Ne sutor ultra crepidam. This nec plus ultra of handicraft wisdom became sheer nonsense from the moment the watchmaker Watt invented the steam engine, the barber Arkwright, the throstle, and the working jeweller, Fulton, the steamship. Footnote. John Bellers, a very phenomenon in the history of political economy, saw most clearly at the end of the 17th century the necessity for abolishing the present system of education and division of labour, which beget hypertrophy and atrophy at the two opposite extremities of society. Amongst other things, he says this, "An idle learning being little better than the learning of idleness, bodily labour, it's a primitive institution of God, labour being as proper for the body's health as eating is for its living. For what pains a man saves by ease, he will find in disease. Labour adds oil to the lamp of life, when thinking inflames it." A childish, silly employ, a warning this by presentiment against the Bezidaus and their modern imitators, leaves the children's minds silly. Proposals for raising a college of industry of all useful trades and husbandry. End of footnote. So long as factory legislation is confined to regulating the labour in factories, manufactories, etc., it is regarded as a mere interference with the exploiting rights of capital. But when it comes to regulating the so-called home labour, it is immediately viewed as a direct attack on the patria potestas, on parental authority. Footnote. This sort of labour goes on mostly in small workshops, as we have seen in the lace-making and straw-plaiting trades, and as could be shown more in detail from the metal trades of Sheffield, Birmingham, etc. End of footnote. The tender-hearted English Parliament long affected to shrink from taking this step. The force of facts, however, compelled it at last to acknowledge that modern industry, in overturning the economic foundation on which was based the traditional family, and the family labour corresponding to it, had also unloosened all traditional family ties. The rights of the children had to be proclaimed. The final report of the Children's Employment Commission of 1866 states, "It is unhappily, to a painful degree, apparent throughout the whole of the evidence, that against no persons do the children of both sexes so much require protection as against their parents." The system of unlimited exploitation of children's labour in general, and the so-called home labour in particular, is maintained only because the parents are able, without check or control, to exercise this arbitrary and mischievous power over their young and tender offspring. Parents must not possess the absolute power of making their children mere machines to earn so much weekly wage. The children and young persons, therefore, in all such cases, may justifiably claim from the legislature as a